All right. Well, I'm very pleased to introduce our first full-length talk for today. We have Simon Harbin, who is Professor of English Language and Literature and Fellow and Tutor in English at Magdalen College, Oxford. He has published widely on medieval literature and the English language. He has lectured to a variety of audiences on C.S. Lewis and has published articles on Lewis's scholarly writings. He is the author of C.S. Lewis's Oxford with Bodleian Publishing, which examines the role that Oxford, its colleges, libraries, chapels, common rooms, and pubs played in fostering the work of one of the 20th century's most influential writers and thinkers. So please welcome Professor Simon Harbin.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Grace, for the introduction. And this, I think, follows on quite neatly from what Caroline's just been talking about, because what I want to think about is where the origins of Narnia lie, and particularly thinking about it in relation to C.S. Lewis's biography, his early years, but also particularly his Oxford life. And I thought that a useful starting point for that would be the moment when he first matriculated in Oxford. We have a nice photo here of his matriculation at University College in April 1917, and here he is with the entire student body at UNIF. It's quite telling, I think, isn't it, what sort of strange time it was to come up and be a student in Oxford. And in fact, Lewis himself, by November of that year, was also on the Western Front. But that's him back right, by the way, if you don't recognise him. And he's actually a student there of classics. So Caroline was talking about the importance of the Oxford English course, but the classical course is obviously also important too, as we know and as you heard yesterday from Beppe Pezzini. And Lewis, unlike Tolkien, completed the Oxford Classics degree. I mean, with the break for fighting in the First World War, he came back, returned to Oxford at the beginning of 1919, and did his Classics degree, getting a double first. And then at the end of it, he set out to become an academic philosopher, in fact, applied for philosophy jobs, including one in classical languages and literature at Magdalen, but he was unsuccessful. We still have his rejection letter in the college archives. but in the meantime, his tutor suggested that it would be a good idea to do an English degree because there were more jobs going in English at that time, so it was a relatively new subject. He thought that would increase his opportunities to get an academic position. And given that Lewis had read much of the Oxford English course already, even though, as we heard, it was focused really on the Old and Middle English periods, that was essentially what Lewis read as a young man. So he was already pretty well read in that course, and in fact he did it in a year and graduated with another first. And at this point, Magdalen College advertised its first tutorial fellowship in English. This is in 1925, and Lewis successfully applied for it. So it turned out to be great advice from his tutor, because he snapped up a job quite soon afterwards. So he moved in to Magdalen into the new buildings here in the summer of 1925. It's actually the centenary of that moment right now. And here he is sitting in his rooms in those familiar surroundings that we often see pictures of him surrounded by numerous pipes and inkwells and the tools of his trade, I suppose. And he was here from 1925 to 1954. When he moved to Cambridge, but of course he'd done much of his writing during that Oxford period. So again, I think this focus on Oxford is quite relevant thinking about Lewis too. And it's also in those rooms that he met with the Inklings, which is obviously another important group for thinking about Oxford fantasy, which sort of coalesced around Lewis and Tolkien. It's actually a group that began at University College. It was founded by one of the students there, and they gave it the name Inklings. But when the student left, the group fizzled out, and Lewis and Tolkien kept meeting, and then they took the group and the name to Magdalen, where it would meet on a Thursday night after dinner to read to each other from the work that they were writing. We all know about the Inklings and the Eagle and Child, which is also a regular meeting haunt, but actually that was a Tuesday morning sort of drinking and gossiping kind of event, rather than the serious business of reading to each other. So I think the importance of the interaction between these groups is obviously significant for Lewis. And it's worth remembering that he didn't begin his fantasy writing with Narnia. So this is a famous quotation from a letter that Tolkien wrote in the 60s about how they began the process of writing what for Lewis became space travel books, where apparently Lewis had said to Tolkien one day, "Tollers, there's too little of what we really like in stories. I'm afraid we shall have to try and write some ourselves." And we agreed that he should write space travel and I should write time travel. And so that's what led to Lewis writing Out of the Silent Planet, the first of what became a trilogy, Perelandra, and then That Hideous Strength. And of course, Tolkien in the meantime wrote some of, but not very much of, The Lost Road. And the Inklings was a really quite productive period for Lewis. Those Second World War years is when he wrote much of his best-known works. The first of his apologetics, Problem of Pain, and then, as I said, Out of the Silent Planet, which was also read to the Inklings, Screwtape Letters, then Perelandra, The Great Divorce. And in the meantime, Tolkien was reading what they called the New Hobbit Book, which was obviously Lord of the Rings. And that's that famous Inklings letter, which you've probably seen reproduced in various books. It's a thank you letter that Lewis wrote to one of his American supporters who sent him food parcels during and after the war because of rationing. And they've just at this point eaten a ham that he sent and partaken of his health, drunk his health. And then they all sign it. So you can see we've got Lewis, we've got at the bottom J.R.R. Tolkien, but we also have Christopher Tolkien, who was invited along when he was a student here in Oxford. And he also read English, I should point out. In fact, was taught by C.S. Lewis. But then other people too, some from the English faculty, so Hugo Dyson and Lord David Cecil, both members of the English faculty, but Colin Hardy was a tutor in classics at Magdalen. And then we've also got Robert Havard, who was Lewis's doctor, and Warney Lewis, who was a returning soldier, Lewis's brother. So it's a bit more of a mixed group. But I think it does still focus in and around the university and particularly the study of English and classics. And one of the things to point out about this in sort of my prelude to thinking about Narnia is that what made Lewis famous, in fact, was the Screwtape Letters. You know, that's what makes him become a household name both here and in the USA. So for instance, you know, you may have seen this picture of him appearing on Time magazine, which was dated to September 1947. So that's when he's really become, you know, very big name in the US. And you can see the devil on his shoulder there. And it says Oxford C.S. Lewis, his heresy, Christianity. So, you know, it's a reference explicitly to Screwtape, the book that became such a bestseller. And the point to sort of emphasize there is that, of course, that's before he'd even begun publishing the Narnia stories. So this is what made him a big name. He even, in Britain, appeared in a photo shoot in Vogue magazine in July 1950. I don't know how many Magdalen fellows have ever had a photo shoot in Vogue. I expect not many. Yeah, if I ever get invited to do one, I'm not going to do it in my dressing gown. It famously was very cold in the new buildings in that period, with sort of rationing on coal and no central heating. So he did teach in his dressing gown. But why he did the photo shoot in it, I have no idea. And what exactly that pose is supposed to be, I'm also unclear. And 1950 is actually the date of the first of the Narnia stories, The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, but it didn't come out until October of that year. So again, it sort of proves my point, I think, that he was still a household name, or at least he was very well known before the books for which he is best known today. So that brings me on to the Narnia stories, and particularly The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, and to sort of address that question of where did this come from? Because actually, it's not an obvious move for a bachelor don living in Magdalen College in his 40s, who's written some fantasy fiction, but also lots of Christian apologetics, At the time, he was working on his major contribution to scholarship, which was his volume for the Oxford History of English Literature, which took him so long that he always called it the Oh Hell volume. But he did, you know, eventually publish it as a major contribution to the study of the 16th century. So he was working on that. And you might think, well, why at that point would he decide to write a children's story? And why this particular kind of children's story? Well, of course, there are lots of different explanations, and probably the best known one, certainly if you hire an Oxford tour guide to take you around Oxford, this is the one that you'll be told, which is that it was walking out of St. Mary the Virgin, the University Church, one snowy winter's evening, that he found himself in St. Mary's Passage with the lamppost, and then opposite him this doorway with these two strikingly gilded fawns on either side of it, and then carved into the wooden door what appears to be a lion's head, that gave Lewis that moment where suddenly all those different features of the first Narnia story kind of coalesced in his imagination. You know, so you've got Lucy going through the wardrobe and being confronted by Mr. Tumnus, the blanket of snow, the lamppost of lantern waste, and then subsequently Aslan. And that's obviously a great story. I'm somewhat skeptical of it, as I will as I will explain, but I can see its power. And of course, you know, when we talk about Lewis's Oxford, we need to think about the Oxford today and the way that Lewis has his own stories of part of the Oxford that we know today. And I sometimes take people around Oxford talking about Lewis's legacy, and I can be sure. In fact, I did it about a couple of weeks ago. Went to that very spot to pour cold water on that very story. And no fewer than three different tourist groups turned up to tell exactly that story while I was there. So it's kind of proved my point, but it also shows how powerful the story is. The reason why I'm skeptical of it, well, there are a number of reasons, but the key one, I suppose, is that Lewis gave a very different account of where the story came from. When he was interviewed and asked about it, he said, "All seven of my Narnia books and my three science fiction books began with seeing pictures in my head. At first, they were not a story, just pictures. The lion all began with a picture of a fawn carrying an umbrella and parcels in a snowy wood. This picture had been in my head since I was about 16. Then one day when I was about 40, I said to myself, let's try to make a story about it." So it's quite an intriguing account, isn't it? And Lewis himself casts scorn elsewhere, by the way, on accounts that authors give of how stories came to them, which makes you wonder about it. But you know, he's very clear on the idea that it begins with pictures. Just as Tolkien says, it all began with names or words. For Lewis, it's visual. But it goes back to when he was about 16, which is before he ever set foot in Oxford. So if we want to be, you know, sort of really literal about this, then it really can't have been that doorway that inspired him. But of course, that just pushes it back to his Belfast childhood. And of course, you won't be surprised to hear there are many lampposts in Belfast, wardrobes and so on, that are claimed. And in fact, one particular wardrobe is this one, which is the one that now stands in the Marion Wade Centre Museum at Wheaton College, just outside Chicago, which is the Lewis family wardrobe. It was carved by Lewis's grandfather. And when his father died, Lewis had it shipped over from Belfast so that he could have it in his Oxford home. So it was obviously an important wardrobe. And various stories have grown up about it and said that when he was a small boy, he used to sit in the wardrobe and tell stories to his brother. I don't know how easy it would be to sit in that wardrobe, but maybe I'm being too literal about all of this. And also being even more literal, the one in the story, we're told, is the sort of wardrobe that has a looking glass in the door, and this one doesn't. So again, you know, that it fails the test in that regard. But you know, should we think about fantasy in terms of, you know, trying to locate the real world inspiration for something? This, incidentally, is the house that Lewis grew up in, Little Lee in Belfast. It's the one he describes at the beginning of surprised by joy, if you know, when he says they move from the small house to this enormous house in the countryside. And there was a little room at the end of the upstairs passage where his brother and he apparently used to go and write stories. Now that we can believe because many of those stories survive. A world that they created of talking animals called Boxen. And you might think, well, this is an obvious first sort of start on the Narnia stories. We've got animals talking, who are dressed. But in fact, it lacks any of the kind of actual fantasy element. These are essentially behave and talk as if they were humans. And they talk about politics and things, and it's Lewis trying to be very grown up. And in fact, he says in Surprised by Joy that there is no trace of the kind of imaginative world which he was inhabiting and which he was reading extensively in, but he wasn't writing it really at that point. And I said that there were various inspirations around Belfast that are claimed, and here's the church where Lewis was baptised, which was where his grandfather was the minister, and this is the vicarage, and this is its doorknob, which, you know, again, it's, of course, there's a little plaque saying, you know, this may have been the inspiration for Aslan. But, you know, another thing that Lewis himself did point to when he was asked about the inspiration for Narnia was that he said he got the name for the place from a classical atlas that he was using when he was a schoolboy. And this is that classical atlas, and here you probably don't know if you can make it out, but there is a place on it called Narnia. It's now Narni in Italy, and sort of hilltop town in Umbria. And he said that he was just looking through this map. So the Latin form of Narni is Narnia, and that he drew upon that name because he liked the sound of it. Again, that's interesting in relation to what I said about Tolkien and place names, I think. So Narnia was already there in his mind as an interesting name. Of course, he never went there or anything. I mean, Lewis, like Tolkien, was not well travelled at all. So that brings us then back to Oxford. I think I've sort of suggested that he got the idea. These pictures were in his mind when he was back in his teens. And he was obviously writing stories, reading widely. But it's not until in his 40s, when he's living in Oxford, that he decides to see if he can make a story about it. And we might wonder, why at that particular point would he decide to do that? Well, I said he was living in the new buildings at Magdalen, so he moved in there in 1925. But in 1930, he also bought a family home on the edge of Oxford in Risinghurst, known as the Kilns. If you haven't been there, you can make an appointment. It's now a kind of study centre owned by an American foundation, but you can make an appointment and go and have a guided tour of the Kilns. It's been reconstructed to look exactly as it was when they lived there. It's not actually authentic, but it does give you the sense of it. And why this is significant, I think, is because in 1939, four schoolgirls were evacuated from London to avoid the bombing and brought to Lewis's house on the edge of Oxford. And throughout, they would sort of change over time. But throughout the war, he had these evacuee children living with him. And he writes very warmly about them to his friends at the time. And he says, you know, I never really appreciated children until the war brought them to me. So I think that's a point where he's sort of looking back at his own childhood. He even says to, you know, his brother at one point, you know, they keep saying, what shall we do? And he says, nothing like our childhood, because they, you know, they were immersed in their stories and in their imaginative worlds. I think he's sort of somewhat frustrated and surprised at these children and their lack of imagination. But he obviously enjoys having them around. And so that I think is quite striking, not least because, of course, if we remember how the book opens, The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, that is, it's with four children being evacuated from London to stay with a somewhat forgetful old professor living in a rambling house in the countryside. So it's not difficult to see where Lewis might be, you know, why that might be the trigger that makes him think at this point, children around, he's got a context for the book, and at that point he decides to see if he can make a story about it. We don't know exactly when that happened, but there is a first go which survives on the back of a page on a story called The Dark Tower, which was an unfinished science fiction story that Lewis had begun writing, never finished, but on the back of one of those leaves is this aborted opening. And I'll show you just a transcription of it so we can see what it says. It says, this book is about four children whose names were Anne, Martin, Rose, and Peter. But it is most about Peter, who was the youngest. They all had to go away from London suddenly because of air raids, and because father, who was in the army, had gone off to the war, and mother was doing some kind of war work. They were sent to stay with a relation of mother's, who was a very old professor, who lived by himself in the country. So probably those of you who know the book well will recognise that that is very similar to the opening of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. But there are some kind of key and very striking differences, I think, aren't there? Let's have a look at the same beginning, but in the published version. Once there were four children whose names were Peter, Susan, Edmund and Lucy. This story is about something that happened to them when they were sent away from London during the war because of the air raids. They were sent to the house of an old professor who lived in the heart of the country, 10 miles from the nearest railway station and 2 miles from the nearest post office. So I suppose the most striking difference there is to do with the names of the children, and particularly to the fact that Peter, who the first one says this story is going to be mostly about, because he was the youngest, has now become the oldest. And Lucy, who's not mentioned before, has replaced him as the youngest. And of course, you could really say that the story is mostly about Lucy in the sense that she's the person who first finds Narnia. And that change may well be related to the dedication that we find in the book, which is to a Lucy, Lucy Barfield, the daughter of his great friend, fellow student and fellow inkling, Owen Barfield. And he says, it's very sweet, this dedication. I'm just going to read it to you because it's so lovely. My dear Lucy, I wrote this story for you, but when I began it, I had not realised that girls grow quicker than books. As a result, you're already too old for fairy tales, and by the time it is printed and bound, you will be older still. But someday you will be old enough to start reading fairy tales again. You can then take it down from some upper shelf, dust it, and tell me what you think of it. I shall probably be too deaf to hear and too old to understand a word you say, but I shall still be your affectionate godfather, C.S. Lewis. And that's Lucy Barfield in 1947. So he's clearly, in some senses, addressing this to a particular Lucy as well, and that's obviously part of the change that undergoes. But I think other than that, I mean, and the other obvious connection is that if we think of him as the doddery old professor who's living in the countryside, we'd also remember that he's called Professor Kirk, which is a nod to his old, not school teacher, because Lewis left school at about the age of 14 and went for private tuition in the English, in a village in Surrey, where he was taught by W.H. Kirkpatrick. And there's clearly, you know, influences there. But other than that, I think we don't find many personal influences in the story as it is. So where do these ideas come from then? Where do some of the... what was it in Lewis's life at that time, and particularly his life as an Oxford English tutor, that may have influenced the stories? And I want to explore some of those things, going back to some of the things that Caroline mentioned about the nature of the English course and how it might have influenced these stories. One feature of these stories, of course, in the Narnia stories, is that there are all kinds of strange beasts, mixtures of human and mythical beasts. There's a nice example of that where Edmund is walking through the witch's courtyard, where he's surrounded by these strange creatures that have been turned to stone. And he says there are lots of them standing around like pieces on a chessboard. And these include things like wolves, bears, catamountains, and dragons, and And then later on, of course, there's even a kangaroo. One possible inspiration for that that I'm sort of intrigued by, but I'm, as you know, skeptical of the idea that there are particular real world influences, are these strange creatures that inhabit the cloisters at Magdalen College, standing like they're stone statues, rather like you get in the witch's courtyard. And it says in that description that they were like chess pieces on a board. And these are like little chess pieces sitting on their parapets around there. But again, it's tempting. But there's another important influence, I think. And if we look at another description of these strange mythical beasts, there's here the creatures that side with the white witch in the story, we're told, are they're so terrifying that he can't describe them, because if he did, then the grown-ups wouldn't let them read, the children read the stories. But he calls them cruels and hags and incubuses, wraiths, horrors, efreets, sprites, orkneys, woozes, and ettins. Now, I suspect the children were wondering what these creatures were, because they'd have had to have done some pretty recondite reading as children to know what a wooze, an orkney, an ettin, and so on were. But one thing that they could have been reading to find out would have been Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, a text that, of course, Lewis was very familiar with as a young man, but also as a tutor, one of the standard features of any medieval syllabus, 14th century alliterative poem. And here you can see that Gawain, on his journey to find the Green Knight in the chapel, we're told that he fights against wurmes, dragons and wolvers, wodwos, bulls and boars, and bears, and ettains. So those are giants. So these are the ettins, and the woozes is the wodwos, and then we've got the wolves and the boars and the bulls. So many of the same creatures that are turning up with the White Witch here, you can also find in this description of Sir Gawain. And we know that Lewis was a careful student of this poem, because his own copy actually survives, heavily annotated like all his books, even with some illustrations to help you make sure you understood all of the strange architectural technical vocabulary that the poet uses there. And then ettins, we find them not just at the on the side of the White Witch and the Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, but of course we find them in Ettins Moor. This is Old English Eoten. That's that same line again, the giants. And you can see that Lewis is using Ettins Moor, and these are the ettins that the children Scrub and Pole and Puddleglum encounter in the silver chair. And you can see Ettin Moors is also a feature of Middle-earth too. And then wodwos, that's the word that Lewis uses as woos, wudu waza, which means it's an Old English word for a wild man of the woods, a savage, a satyr or a fawn. And I've given you a quote there from Lord of the Rings too, because Lewis and Tolkien are very similar in their way of sort of taking these medieval words and repurposing them in their fantasy worlds. And we know about Orc, I'm sure, so Orkney. So the White Witch also has the Orkneys on her side, and this is the Old English word Orc, demon or evil spirit, which again, of course, is another feature of Middle Earth. Another obvious source for these kinds of beasts are these lines in Beowulf, in which the poet tries to explain, this is a Christian poet looking back on a pagan world and trying to understand how, in a world created good, could we have all these strange monstrous creatures? And he says that they were all the progeny of Cain, the first murderer. And he says, you know, along with those we find Eotonas, that's the word, ettins again, giants, and Orkneas, Orkneys, as Lewis would call them. The orcs for Tolkien, such giants who, for a long time, warred against God. And worms, this is the Old English word worm or dragon, which of course is a very important feature of Tolkien's world. Now we don't see that in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, in fact, but worms do make an appearance later on, of course. And this scene here, the conversation with Smaug, where Bilbo is trying to rescue the Arkenstone, where you've got a dragon on a hoard of treasure, does turn up also in Narnia, of course, because Lewis draws on precisely the same sources as Tolkien is drawing on here in that famous episode in The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, if you remember, where he's Eustace finds himself confronted by a dragon. If you remember that Eustace, though, of course, has read all the wrong books. When he was a child, he read books of information instead of books of imagination. And it comes back to bite him when he finds himself confronted by a huge hoard of treasure, and he doesn't know what this might signify. So let me just read this bit to you. At the bottom of the cliff, a little on his left hand, was a low, dark hole, the entrance to a cave, perhaps, and out of this, two thin wisps of smoke were coming. And the loose stones just beneath the dark hollow were moving. That was the noise he had heard, just as if something were crawling in the dark behind them. Something was crawling. Worse still, something was coming out. Edmund, or Lucy, or you would have recognised it at once. You see, he's recalling that, of course, the reader does read books of imagination and fantasy. But Eustace had read none of the right books. The thing that came out of the cave was something he had never even imagined. A long, lead-coloured snout, dull red eyes, no feathers or fur, a long, lithe body that trailed on the ground, legs whose elbows went right up higher than its back, like a spider's. I don't know if dragons really have elbows, do they? But maybe that's the right word. Cruel claws, bat's wings that made a rasping noise on the stones, yards of tail, as the two lines of smoke were coming from its nostrils. He never said the word dragon to himself, nor would it have made things any better if he had. So here's a nice moment of encountering the fantastical and being unable to recognise it, being unable to recognise the danger that's clearly presented by a large hoard of treasure, you know, because he'd read all the wrong books. And even more significantly, of course, what goes on to happen is, although you'd expect at this point there'd be some kind of big encounter between Eustace and the dragon, like, of course, we get between Bilbo and Smaug, you know, that great kind of riddling conversation, which itself comes straight from Old Norse. Here, the dragon simply drops down dead. And it's a somewhat anticlimactic kind of moment. You think, that wasn't what I was expecting at all. And what Eustace does is it starts to rain. He goes and has a sleep in the cave. And then, of course, he wakes up and finds what you or I would have known, anyone who's read all the right books, is that if you go to sleep on a dragon's hoard with greedy, dragonish thoughts in your mind, you, of course, turn into a dragon. That's evidently what had happened to the dragon in the first place. And again, this goes right back to Volsunga saga and to the Norse legends. And so, you know, again, very like Tolkien, Lewis is drawing upon the stories that he knew well, both from his reading as a child, but also from his work within the Oxford English faculty. And so that's, I think, why the Oxford English course, particularly when it comes to Lewis and Tolkien, is such a critical part of both of their fantasy worlds. And I think it's fair to say that, you know, we need to think also about the relationship between the two men, because they have a profound influence on each other. You know, I think I sort of highlight the way in which they're both doing similar things, using similar kinds of ideas and words to create similar kinds of effects. Caroline mentioned the fact that the course in those days was rigorously philological. And I think that, I'm sure she meant it in a positive way. It wasn't fully implied. but Lewis, I think, came from a different tradition to Tolkien, in that he was more kind of literary inclined in his viewpoint. And in fact, you know, there's that famous story of their first meeting, which very conveniently Lewis left an account of it in his diary. This was in May 1926, so not long after Lewis had got his job at Magdalen, Tolkien returned to Oxford from Leeds, and the two men met at a meeting of the English faculty. And they disagreed on a number of things. They disagreed on the value of the works of Edmund Spenser, which must have really irritated Lewis, because he was a great fan of Spenser. And Tolkien said he couldn't read it because of the forms. He didn't like the language. And then they disagreed on the prominence of language study to the English syllabus, very significantly. That was something that was that Tolkien thought was the real thing in the language school, as Lewis puts it. Lewis was much more skeptical. So I think they did disagree quite heavily on the extent to which the syllabus should be rigorously philological and to what extent it should be about reading literature. They both thought it should be about reading early literature. I mean, Lewis again thought that modern literature, you don't need to teach somebody how to blow their nose, he says. So why should you teach them how to read Dickens? But so they both believed it should be focused on these periods. And so I think these texts were absolutely central to them. But Lewis was somewhat slower to come to an appreciation of philology, as it was. And that was really under the influence of Lewis. And in fact, the syllabus that Tolkien created in the 1930s, which is the very rigorously philological one, initially Lewis was quite skeptical of it, but Tolkien won him round. And he became one of his great, most sort of vociferous supporters as they pushed through these big and far-reaching changes to the syllabus. And in fact, in the 50s, when the whole issue of syllabus reform came up again, because it was by that time quite a lot of pushback against philology and against the idea that everything should stop at 1830, and there was a working group formed to decide on these matters. And they came up, and Tolkien was on the working group, they came up with proposals to change it. And when they were presented to the faculty, Lewis was outraged that Tolkien had gone against the syllabus they first both introduced. And he then went around campaigning so rigorously for keeping things status quo, that even Tolkien voted against the proposals that he himself had put together. So it was very confusing, isn't it? That he essentially stuck with. So even in the 50s, this was still a rigorously philological syllabus. But I think that's why it's so important, because these words like wooze, etin, worm, and so on, are ones that they are, and I'm sure you heard something of this yesterday, thinking about Tolkien, the word ent, again, you know, he talks about the word ent, which is an old English word for a giant, being a word that he wants to do something about. Because they're words that are sort of like blank checks in a way. We don't know precisely what they refer to. They refer to some creatures of olden times. And that allows you the potential to imagine what they might have been like. And I think that's a kind of spur to both men. So Lewis just as much as it is to Tolkien. Good. So I think at that point I'm going to draw things to a conclusion, and then I'm very happy to take any questions that anyone might have. Thank you.
So when I remember back to when I was a child and first met the Library Wardrobe, one of the most memorable scenes for me was when Edmund meets the witch as treated to Turkish delight and hot chocolate and a sleigh. I was interested, I didn't actually know much about C.S. Lewis's history. Just mentioned he wasn't very well travelled, so I guess I'm curious, where did Turkish delight come from? Is there
that's a good question. One I've pondered a lot. So Turkish connections, Aslan is the Turkish word for a lion, and he says he met that in the Tales of the Arabian Nights, and he used it because he liked the sound of it, but he also liked the fact that it has the word ass. He pronounced it Aslan because ass is the Norse word for a god. So it is a, it's an interesting name. And it's Turkish, so that I don't think explains or answers your question, but it sort of hints at a Turkish connection. And I suppose the other thing is, you know, if you read stories at the time, children's books that he read, Edith Nesbit and so on, Turkish Delight does pop up as a kind of fairly standard sweet treat. I don't know how many other kinds of sweet treats he would have known. But the other one that intrigues me, but you know, you can pour scorn on this if you like, but at Magdalen College, after, you know, we have a thing called second dessert in Oxford, which is, you know, you've eaten dessert already, and then someone says, do you want some dessert? And you think, that's odd. And this is where different colleges do it differently. But it's essentially a collection of sort of exotic fruits, port, chocolates, and so on. But one thing we have at Magdalen, which I have not yet found at any other college's second dessert, is Turkish Delight. So perhaps he was inspired by, you know, his own experience of eating it or a particular love of it. I don't know. Or maybe we have it at Magdalen because of Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. I don't know. Yeah, exactly, yeah.
That's interesting, isn't it?
So one of the questions online we have has to do with the use of Old English words by Lewis, and the question is, do you think that this caused Old English words to get popular in more recent fantasy?
I would guess so, but I don't know enough about more recent fantasy to know if that's where they're getting it from, and what the specific examples would be, but that seems rather likely, doesn't it? And I don't know if the person asking has a particular example, but that, I mean, I guess it's either there or it's going back to the medieval sources themselves, so in some cases it might be that, but I would have thought that, yeah, that to some extent that is being the more likely source, yeah.
Thank you very much for this. I really enjoyed it. And I especially enjoyed what you were saying at the end, sort of about the difference between Lewis and Tolkien on philology and Lewis's more sort of literary sensibilities. And forgive me if you touched on this and I missed it, but there's a scholar, Michael Ward, who's written about kind of the cosmological background to Lewis's approach, and it's sort of suggested that if you look at things like the Cosmic Trilogy or the Space Trilogy and some of his poetry, The Discarded Image, these things that have to do with sort of the sense of the medieval cosmology, this might be in fact one of Lewis's stronger drives, and that even you might see each of the planets represented in the chronicles themselves. Do you have any thoughts on that at all?
Yeah, thanks. I think that he spotted something that's important about the, and he uses the term atmosphere of the stories, which, you know, Lewis wrote about atmosphere being a really key part of storytelling, didn't he? That famous essay on stories, which talks about how, why do we go back to our favorite stories? It's surely not for the plot, because we know what's going to happen. It's because of the atmosphere. And I think, and he talks, Michael Ward coined the term Donegality for, you know, why do you go back to Donegal all the time? And what is it about Donegal? And it's the same for any place, you know, like the sort of Oxonianness of Oxford or something. And I think that this kind of planetary, these planetary elements that he has identified are important and telling. So, for instance, that he associates the Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe with Jupiter. It's about kingship and so on. I think there are lots of sort of important kind of resonances that come out from having that foregrounded in the way that he's done in his book. But I slightly shy away from the kind of Narnia code type side of it, which is what the kind of popular version of Planet Narnia was called, because it suggests that was the kind of key to understanding these stories, and that Lewis set out to hide it within them, and that it was there to kind of, yeah, to explain them in some way. And I think that just takes it too far. And not least because it's clear that Lewis wrote The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe as a one-off. And he didn't really intend to write a series of books at that point. And at the end of it, he then starts thinking about a sequel. One imagines the publisher is contacting him at the time, and he's thinking, well, I've probably got more I can say. But he's casting around for ideas at that point. He's got plenty of them. I mean, you know, his imagination is constantly bubbling up, I think. But he's not planned ahead in the way that you would have to if you're thinking about it as a series of planetary novels. And then I think it does start to get going as a series, and it's only really, I would say, about towards the end of it that he specifically and explicitly in a letter to some children says that there are going to be 7 of them. So he has decided at that point, but he certainly hasn't at the beginning. I think it's much more happenstance. And I can see how he might think, I'm going to write a book about The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. It's going to involve kingship and Jupiter, and things associated with Jupiter are going to be prominent. But that, I don't think, means that the whole series was intended to, or that somehow, it's a bit reductive in its most extreme form, that idea, I would say. But it's a really rich book, I would say, you know, for anyone who hasn't read Planet Narnia, it's really worth reading. It's very scholarly, there's lots to get out of it.
I was wondering, you said C.S. Lewis did complete his last 6 degree, and obviously Tolkien tried. Why do you think, like, the sort of the study of English really then gone to, like, kind of supersedes all the classical, like, kind of influences they might have had? Like, it seems like all that sort of right territory isn't as big a deal to them as, like, the later stuff is. Why do you think, like, the North stuff wins, basically?
Well, I suppose I could say, I mean, for instance, if it starts with an image of a fawn standing in a snowy wood, then you could say the classical literature is still fairly prominent. I don't think, I mean, because of course part of what Tolkien seems to object to in Narnia is that it isn't just a kind of a consistent worldview. It's a jumbling of mythologies and literatures, and therefore the classical side of it, you know, Dionysus turns up and Bacchus, and you know, there are lots of classical moments in Narnia, and so I don't think that's all gone away. But could it have been superseded? Perhaps, because I think maybe that is a more productive mode for Lewis, in particular, that the medieval. But I think he's still, you know, that there are moments where, you know, Milton and Shakespeare, and you know, there's a richness to Narnia, which obviously didn't appeal to Tolkien in that, if that's to be believed. But I think that is what Lewis is doing. You know, I mean, for instance, one obvious example of the Miltonic influence would be the creation of Narnia. You know, what he calls the founding of Narnia in The Magician's Nephew, where Aslan is sort of singing the world into being, and the animals start to appear. If you remember, they come up from under the ground and start bursting through the earth, and then you've got these sort of strange branching twig-like things, and it turns out to be the antlers of a deer that comes up through the ground, and then the sort of big baggy trousered elephant comes up. And he's just got this directly from Milton's description of creation in Paradise Lost. So, you know, I think Lewis is a bit of a magpie, and all the things that he likes turn up in Narnia, and that's classics. It's some classical stuff as well as it is all kinds of English literature.
Thanks again so much for the talk. It's so fascinating. I was just wondering, I don't know if I read somewhere or that Narnia came after The Hobbit. Mm-hmm. And he was possibly inspired to write a children's story because The Hobbit had been so successful. Is that right?
Well, there's a bit of a gap, but it certainly came after it. And, I mean, obviously the dating around The Hobbit is slightly tricky as well, but we know that Lewis was given a copy of the manuscript in the early 1930s to read it. You know, it didn't get published until 1937. And again, that's largely because, of course, Tolkien wasn't planning to publish it himself. He wrote it for his children. And that's, again, where there's an interesting contrast. But the first of these people I mentioned to write a children's story was actually Owen Barfield, who wrote The Silver Trumpet, which came out in 1925. And he lent it to Lewis, who lent it to Tolkien, who read it to his children. And it was a great favourite with them, he says. So he actually began that process. But Barfield and Tolkien had children that they were reading to, and that's how the stories kind of emerged. Lewis did read The Hobbit early on and enthused greatly about it. And of course, he was a big believer in, you know, reading fairy tales when you're a grown-up. As he says to Lucy, you know, you might go off them for a bit, but you'll be old enough one day to read them again. So in that sense, I think that, you know, The Hobbit could have inspired him as a concept, but it's quite a bit earlier than when he sits down to write the Narnia story. It must have made a difference that his friends had written children's stories, I suppose. And interesting what you suggest about maybe the success of it, as if perhaps he's thinking, you know, like the sort of, oh, look, there's money to be made in these books. But I don't think Lewis thought in those terms, really. Like he says, there's one other article where he's being asked about the origins of the Narnia stories, and he said, it was one of those moments in my life where write a fairy story was what I had to do or burst. So it's coming from within him, I think, largely. I mean, he doesn't really, again, explain what he means by that, but there's something he needed to get down. And the fairy story, he says, was the only mode in which I could write it.
Thank you. So I'm just going to read out loud the question, which is in two parts. And it's up to you which one you first. So the question is it ever going to be possible to create a fantasy atmosphere or universe that is not steeped in the classical mythology, legends, folk and fairy tales, language and locations, such as Oxford, that inspired the fantasy pioneers like Tolkien and Lewis, and something closer to C.S. Lewis? And then where does the Philandra trilogy differ? Deficit in relation to fantasy versus sci-fi. So I guess.
Sorry, I didn't catch the last bit of that.
I guess the question is, where does the Philandra trilogy sits in relation to fantasy and sci-fi? Kind of, do we talk about it as sci-fi or is it fantasy still? Thank you.
No, that's for somebody who really knows about the sci-fi genre. I would think that by modern standards, it's pretty poor sci-fi. You've got no interest in any of the technical stuff, how you get to Mars and making it remotely believable. It's more of a kind of, well, he calls it kind of sort of philosophical sci-fi, I think. Maybe it's much closer to kind of H.G. Wells, that kind of writing. Than it is modern sci-fi, I suspect. And the first question was about, is it possible to write fantasy without... Well, no, you have to do an Oxford English degree. I think we're making that abundantly clear, aren't we? You have to read Beowulf, you have to read Sir Gawain and the Green Knight in the original language, study your ettins and wooses, and then, you know, you're all set. But no, of course you can make things up, can't you? That's the beauty of it, I guess. But it's obviously a rich and productive way of sort of, you know, drawing on. I mean, Tolkien in particular, I guess. But I think Lewis too has had an important influence on modern fantasy writing.
Do you think that Lewis, in taking inspiration from all of the things around him, is perhaps uncreative, writing a story about Charlton and Penelope Sill? Or do you think that we should copy him and also take inspiration from the mundane world around us?
He has a great quote, doesn't he, about going into, about what it means to read about fantastical worlds and magical woods and things. And so he says it's in answer to the, you know, does it mean that everything seems greatly mundane when you've read a fantasy story and then you're back in the real world? And he says reading about enchanted woods doesn't make everything else seem completely mundane, but it makes real woods just a little bit enchanted. And I think that's what he wants to do, is not leave us in this kind of mundane world, but actually to try and see how, in fact, the world that we live in is full of these kinds of amazing and enchanting kind of concepts, and see those potentially as an inspiration to write fantasy. You know, you don't have to think of all other wardrobes as being completely, you know, just boring old functional wooden wardrobes, but actually could be all themselves is slightly enchanted and portals into anywhere else you might want to go.
Well, thanks for bringing me here. Thank you, Simon.